Excellencies,
Deputy Secretary General, Monsignor, Professor, Madam the Director, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, thank you very much. Thank all of you for coming, so many of you for coming. I know from experience that meetings between 1:15 and 2:45 are not very popular, particularly when lunch is not included. So I think that all of the participants here in this room, I consider you to be advocates for national reconciliation, people dedicated to transitional justice. So really, I commend you. And I do want to say that it is a privilege for me to begin 2014 by the launching of the Practical Guide on Transition, Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation Processes in the Francophone Area. This is an initiative. It's commendable. It's very timely. The IOF, the international organization by the IOF, focused on the international community, but there are many Francophone countries which have experienced crises. And this is a subject which is the subject of ongoing study and consideration by those involved. Transitional justice is necessary for countries in conflict or in crisis or in transition to democracy. It is something absolutely necessary. It's obligatory to make people feel at peace, to strengthen national consensus, to reform the structures and the institutions, so to create a political governance system which can be considered owned by all of the people. Transitional justice requires a statement of all of the violence and to establish responsibility and to make it possible for national reconciliation to be achieved. But although there is a national domestic claim, transitional justice is an international requirement. The United Nations, the specialized agencies, international specialized agencies, regional organizations or sub-regional organizations, and bilateral partners recommend transitional justice with the assistance measures to incite this from the international community to help these countries in this transition. The 30-plus experiences with respect to national reconciliation and truth and justice processes, of course, can't fit into a single model. There are particular features for each one. There's original nature of each one. And there is a historic or social context which determine the timing and the profile of each process. The practical guide, which we are launching today, contains a summary of many Francophone and non-Francophone experiences, and you will see a very summary presentation of this experience, and this makes it possible to make comparisons and to offer choices for those who wish to be guided by this experience. And I do hope this will help to initiate bilateral cooperation or trilateral cooperation for the establishment of justice and reconciliation commissions. Of course, there are experiences which are just emerging or will need to be implemented in coming weeks. May I just mention the latest example, which is the example of Tunisia, where it is a question of a Truth and Dignity Commission. And I hope that the academicians here will consider this, but I think that the concept of dignity goes beyond. It goes beyond the simple concept of justice per se. To illustrate some of the experiences, where they came from and the particular features of them and their impact, the IOF has invited experts from Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, and Morocco to hear about their experiences, what they have experienced, and also the lessons that they have learned. The OIF has asked us to, has given us Mr. Christophe Guillou, the Director for Peace, Democracy, and Human Rights of the OIF, Professor Fabrice Urkebi, an expert for the OIF, the IOF. I think that's all. And then for the UN and international aspect, we have Mr. Adama Dieng, Undersecretary General, the Special Advisor for the Secretary General on the Prevention of Genocide. And he was an independent expert in Haiti and a member of the International Tribunal, and he will share what he's seen and been through in very rich experience. Insofar as possible, I will try to limit the time of my colleagues to 7 minutes for each speaker so that we can keep as much time set aside for those who might wish to ask questions or make comments after the presentations. The goal for us, because we have problems with the conference services, we must end at 2:45. So without spending any more time here, I would like to ask Mr. Christophe Guillou, the Director for Peace, Democracy, and Human Rights, to deliver a presentation on the Francophone approach with respect to transitional justice. And may I ask him to, if possible, to limit his comments to 7 minutes and to help him the greetings which I delivered at the beginning of my statement. May I say that these are valid for everyone who's going to speak after me. We're extremely grateful to all of you for being here, and everyone appreciates the fact that our panelists have come here. So please go directly into the subject that you're going to discuss. Christophe, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador,
Mr. Deputy Secretary General, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be with you today to launch this practical guide. This didactic work is unique in its kind. In fact, it's part of what Francophonie does, whose goal is to give more marked coherence to the support action which we are conducting in countries in crisis or countries exiting from crisis. Let us pay due tribute to this. This guide is the result of Mr. Louis Janier, former independent expert of the United Nations. He, about 15 years ago, stated the first guidelines which were the basis for the deployment of this procedure. We're particularly happy that he gave a preface to this work. He should have been with us today, but he was unable to attend. I'd also like to take this opportunity to tell you about the approach and the Francophone analysis which illustrates the production of this document. It is a recapitulation and analysis of experience in the Francophone area, and in fact, it's been a long time that Francophonie has tried to help these member states to go through the essential stages, but delicate stages, towards pluralistic democratization and the consolidation of rights and freedoms. I'll summarize this in answering three questions. First, what do we mean by transitional process, justice, and reconciliation? second question, why do we need this guide? And third, what are the characteristics of the Francophone approach in this respect? To answer the first question, what do we mean by the transition justice and reconciliation processes? In fact, it's a whole series of procedures which, in periods of crisis or exit from crisis, tries to restore lasting peace and peaceful governance. And that through mechanisms for fact-finding and seeking the truth through a national dialogue. Let us now come to the second question, why do we need this guide? We have done it for several reasons. First, because the Francophone area for several years has processes to overcome the effects of abuses committed following conflicts and crises. I'd like to remind you that the IOF includes 77 states and governments on 5 continents. This process also had as its goal to promote national reconciliation and prevent a return to a conflict. These measures have often been encouraged by civil society and are increasingly taken over by governments. There are 29 in the Francophone areas, including the projects, in 19 countries. This guide has as a purpose to collect this information, and it's the first time this has been done. Based on all these cases, they're made available to the stakeholders involved to serve as an example and to draw the most useful lessons from them. We hope they will become a primary tool for practitioners, public opinion, and member states. The third goal is to make known these processes better in the Francophone areas, as well as their wealth and their diversity. The first experience goes back to the years 1990, and we hope this experience will be included in global reflection, particularly in the United Nations, and become true subjects for research. This is just at the initial stage. Let's now come to the third question. What characterizes a Francophone approach? It's based, first of all, on the main reference texts, namely the Declaration of Bamako of 2000 and Saint Boniface of 2006 with regard to peace, security, human rights, and fighting against impunity. It is also based on concrete action on the ground conducted by the IOF in a certain number of countries which we have supported. In the past, it was the case of Togo. Now it's Tunisia, Egypt, Mali, and Madagascar. In the future, it could be the turn of the Central African Republic. So our approach is marked by not having any reference model. We don't provide a key model. On the contrary, we respect diversity of the systems and situations to find a national solution to the problems. That approach is based on several imperatives inherent in the fight against impunity as defined by Louise Rainier: the right to truth, the right to justice, the right to reparation, and guarantees of non-repetition. Never again. We don't want justice to be an obstacle to peace, and we make sure that amnesty take place without discernment. We also try to ensure the complementarity of mechanisms of justice during the transitional period with other forms of justice, which are local, national, regional, and international, and in particular, the International Criminal Court. So in that on that last point, IOF has an agreement with the ICC, and it is in favor of dialogue and reconciliation, like the General States of Justice in different countries in post-crisis periods in Guinea, Chad, and Guinea. Strengthened by this experience and our knowledge, as well as our networks of experts, the IOF is pursuing and strengthening its action in this area. It is clear that from our standpoint, these processes can only be justified if they are implemented with sincerity, including all of the stakeholders. Thank you for your attention.
Je remercie.
I thank Mr. Christophe Guillot for his presentation, and I thank him in particular for having respected the 7-minute limit. Now, without further delay, I give the floor to Fabrice Urshabi, an expert of the IOF, to introduce the guide. You have the floor.
Merci, monsieur.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Deputy Secretary General, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to add to what Mr. Christophe Guillot, the director, said with respect to the disruption of democracy in the Francophone area. And this leaves a void. And so mechanisms of transition, transitional justice, transition justice, truth, and reconciliation can be deployed. Now, to illustrate this, I would like to stress the format of the guide being proposed to you. Actually, this document is intended to be operational, both with respect to the public and in terms of its structure. It's operational with respect to the public because the document is directed primarily to the different actors, participants, the commissions, truth commissions, but also civil society and institutions. Operational in terms of the structure of the guide as well. The introduction of the guide will introduce the Francophone approach, which is described here. This is a reference point here, and there are two parts to that. First, it refers to the situation, the objectives of the process, the difference between the processes and institutional justice, and the link between these processes and national constitutions, and then how they work. And the second subcategory is the presentation. This concerns the diversity of the experience. And then there is a conclusion, a chronological one, with regard to the different states in the justice and reconciliation. And you will find several tables in this guide which summarize the information given. And then a third category is experience. This is the central part of this guide because with the different experiences and the restoration of processes, these are very diverse, and and there also a diversity of the institutionals used. And we have established 5 major families. The first families, which are the truth commissioners and or the equivalent institutions. The second, the investigative commissions and the fact-finding commissions. And then the fourth is the international jurisdictional or institutionalized institutions. And then there are the customary or traditional institutions. We have color-coded this so that you can quickly find this within the guide. The purpose of the guide is to be operational and to represent a certain kind of vademecum of the experiences. On the one hand, we made a choice to adopt a common grill for all of the experiences, and then for each of the experiences, you'll see that there are the common instruments, the date, the context, the composition, and the legal basis, the composition, the mandate, the competence of the institution, and then the report. And then what are the conclusions, what are the recommendations, and then what follow-up is being provided for. Then there's a resources category, too, to provide easier access for complementary information and official websites for the institutions. Also, to put into perspective all of this experience, we have called upon on the experiences outside the Francophone area, and 3 of these. They serve here as a background for, and this is like a pilot experience. And then there's a conclusion which is drawn from this picture of the experiences, and this revolves around 4 points. There's a conclusion on the nature of the institutions mobilized, a conclusion on the necessary interaction or synergy among the processes, also a conclusion on the duration of the mandates, and then a conclusion on the sincerity of the processes, which I think is the central point in terms of the effectiveness of the justice, truth, and reconciliation processes. The purposes of the guide have been recalled here. We're not imposing any reference model, and we're not giving pride of place to any model over another, but it relates to the diversity of the legislation in the Francophone area, and also the guide thus seeks to provide information about all of those involved in the process with regard to all of the experience in the Francophone area. And most of the commissioners or those involved do not easily have access to information about foreign examples. So the guide seeks to fill the gaps in information and also to present the challenges that institutions face, and in particular the way in which Allen's institutions overcome these challenges, particularly during the period concerning the establishment of the recommendations and the implementation of the recommendations and of the process. And then the third goal is to make it possible to exchange information and good processes in a summary and functional document. So, in conclusion, what we found is that two major situations have given rise to the transition justice and truth and reconciliation processes. It depends on the situation of crisis or post-crisis. And then frequently, paradoxically, there is the question of remembrance. Frequently, it's the crisis and exit of crisis that enjoys most of the attention, but in these processes are ongoing at the present time, and there are 19 going on at the present time if you include the establishment of commissions. Now, if you analyze the commissions, one sees that, in fact, there are 27 institutional experiences. States can mobilize different institutions, which I've mentioned, 27 institutional experiences, which come to 29 if you include two projects for international or internationalized adjudication. In any case, the main conclusion that the guide reached was that concerned the effectiveness of a transition justice, truth, and reconciliation process. It is undeniably based on the sincerity of the process, and sincerity both on the part of the authority that establishes the process and on the part of those participated, those deploying the process. The sincerity is at the basis of the sense of ownership by civil society, the population, of the entire process. Mr. Chairman, Excellencies, thank you very much.
Je remercie le professeur.
I thank Professor Fabrice Okebi for his statement. I just want to draw attention to the fact that as well as the guide, which is available in this room, I think that the IOF has summarize this in English and in French. It's a small booklet you have here, and I think it shows that it's open up to other dialogues, and that's how we have bilingualism and multilingualism. I'd now like to give the floor to the Under Secretary General of the United Nations, Special Advisor of the Secretary General, Mr. Ada Diem, to make his statement. You have the floor, sir. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. At the risk of missing a few seconds, I would like to address my congratulations to you on the election in the Kingdom of Morocco to the presidencies of Central African Republic, formation for the for the Peace Building Commission. We wish you every success. Our colleague has just told us that tomorrow may be the turn of the RCA. And now I'd like to say that we have to continue more than ever to help Central Africa. Today, you have to immediately think about establishing transitional mechanisms in order to reflect and mobilize on the necessary support so that the authors of atrocities which are committed still before us in Bangui through the Central African Republic be prosecuted in the courts. Now, to talk about courts in the Central African Republic might not be appropriate, but we must note that the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court is seized with this case, and it is examining it with the necessary care, and we have given its entire support. That being so, this should not let us forget that immense progress has been accomplished in this area of Francophonie, in this area where the sun never sets, to take what Mr. Abou Diouf has said. So it is with great interest that my office has accepted the pressing invitation from Ambassador Savoduro to cooperate to launch the practical guide on the transitional process of justice, truth, and reconciliation in the Francophone area. Speaking about we want justice, we want reconciliation. And that is why I just want to remind you that when a crisis of governance is accompanied by violations of human rights on such a large scale, sooner or later, the question of accountability takes place. The fact that abuse was taken place by state agents or by the insurgents, the victims and their oppressors, like the population and the public authorities, must face the dynamics of the collapse of society and the incapacity of the state to protect the rights of all citizens. And that process, however painful, is necessary and often requires the public authorities and society for commitment to have transition and reconciliation through justice. However, the process is almost never a simple and direct operation. When all of the parties have been more or less involved in acts of violence, or when the parties involved still have enough power to abort the reconciliation process, it is important to reflect of the possibility of closing the door to the past, or at least to defer the judicial process so that the institution can be consolidated, so the reopening of the situation does not compromise the future of the country. Amnesty might appear to many countries which are afflicted by such violence as being an easy way to finish with an interminable crisis. But total and lasting amnesia cannot be an option. It is always necessary to take initiatives to help the victims. In order to have a successful transition and to prevent violations of human rights, reconciliation as a process remains effectively inseparable from the fundamental requirements of justice and of peace, so that reconciliation become entrenched in the policies, and in order to get rid of the demons of vengeance or the attempts for justice, truth and justice has to be sought and satisfied together. And that means that if amnesty is necessary, it should be of limited scope and cannot apply to the main perpetrators of international crimes. International interventions with regard to criminal justice is still limited in scope. Other options have to be made at national basis, and if possible, with the aid of the international community through mechanisms of participatory justice based on seeking the truth. Today, truth commissions continue to be used, and they should be included in all of the judiciary transitional processes, together with strengthening judicial mechanisms where the creators of chambers or semi-international courts, like in Sierra Leone or in Cambodia, should take place. But really, today, we have to avoid the mixed commissions and try and strengthen the only permanent tool which we have, that is the International Criminal Court. How can we not mention the case of Rwanda in this year commemorating genocide of 1994? From 1996 to 2000, the number of cases of genocides treated never exceeded 6,000 cases for the entire country. And at that rate, it would need at least one century to finish with all the trials in Rwanda, but aware that there isn't a sanctuary available. The Rwandan authorities have decided to follow their instinct and to launch an ambitious system of justice in a participatory way. The Jakakav jurisdiction. The Jakakav procedures are a traditional system to settle conflicts in the community. The Jakakav process also is retributive because there can be penalties, and we wish to reaffirm that the IOF has an important role to play to accompany transitional processes, in particular in the developing countries. And that strength and support through transitional judiciary mechanism must be combined with global assistance provided by the international community to strengthen the principle of the priority of law in transitional in countries in transition. However, in order to attain that goal, the public authorities and all of the actors in society in the countries concerned, which are still divided, adhere to this global approach of transitional justice and make great efforts to support it. I thank you.
Je remercie.
I thank on behalf of us all Mr. Adama Dieng, the Undersecretary General, and I thank him for his congratulations with respect to the CAR, and I commend his dedication, his courage, it fills us with admiration. And Mr. Adama Dieng is really a proud son of Senegal, but for all of Africa, and Francophonie, too. Now I wish to give the floor to Monsignor Nikonem Bariga Benissen, former chair of the Togolese Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Undersecretary General, ladies and gentlemen, after 34 months of intense activity on the 3rd of April 2012, at an official ceremony, the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission of Togo submitted its initial report with 68 recommendations to the President of the Republic. 11 months later, on the 4th of March 2013, it submitted it to the head of state. It submitted to the head of state the three other volumes concerning the cause of the political violence in Togo, the results of the investigation, and the program of reparation. So what can one learn from this mission, which had a difficult beginning, and together with the financial and level by the international unity, UNDP, the European Union, the OIF, France, Germany, and others all participated. So what has been achieved with respect to the mandate given to the Commission? Let us recall that the Commission was established by a presidential decree on the 25th of February 2009, following national consultations conducted from April 2008 at the invitation of the Togolese government, recommended in 2006 by the political actors and civil society in Articles 2.2 and 2.4 of the agreement signed in Ouagadougou, following what happened in 2005, the Commission had the mandate of identifying the causes of political violence which afflicted the history of Togo from 2005 to 2008, and to establish a program for reparation and to make to the government recommendations concerning the future with respect to the violators of the most serious human rights, and lastly, to formulate recommendations to guarantee the non-repetition of violence, to combat impunity, and to strengthen national reconciliation. The Commission was composed of 11 members, 4 women, it was presided over by a religious official in accordance with the wishes of the people. During its mandate, the Commission heard more than 22,000 witness statements and heard more than 500 victims' statements in hearings concerning the political violence, and in particular, it formulated 68 recommendations concerning the scrupulous respect for human rights, the institutional reform, the organization of society, and reparation programs. In accordance with its mandate, the Commission did not provide any amnesty, nor did engage in prosecution, but it did recommend a reduction of the penalties for the presumed perpetrators who publicly asked for forgiveness of the victims. There would be additional investigation with respect to the violators of more serious crimes with regard to the statistics. So what did the truth, did the Commission really establish? What did it show with respect to Togo up to that point? What justice was rendered? What reconciliation did it help to achieve? What change did it help to effect? Because it was a transitional justice process without any political involvement. Can you quantify these results? Through these very complicated questions, we did understand the Commission referred the very basic question with regard to the four pillars that are at its basis: truth, justice, reconciliation, and the guarantee of non-repetition. Now, with respect to the skepticism for those who feel that a truth commission doesn't fulfill its, can only achieve its mandate through a change in the government, but that wasn't true in Togo. Now, with respect to Togo, the really new facts which were highlighted through the work of the commission there are not many of these. The truth established by it, for some, were well known but to those of Togo, the people of Togo. But the value of the process lies in the fact that it made public the information about the victims. They could speak directly and free speak, and there was a national catharsis. There was thought. Victims were rehabilitated, and there was a new social pact. Now, the Commission mainly helped to strengthen the fight against impunity and gave hope for reconciliation in future on the basis of dialogue, the rule of law, and respect for commitments. And this is why the Commission became an organ for reconciliation, mediation, the settlement of conflicts, and a source of peace. And this was not in its original agenda, but these proved to be of great importance to safeguard national cohesion. At the present time, the sense that most of the Togolese feel is that the Commission was more a mechanism to bring peace to the society and propose reforms than a real instrument for the pursuit of justice. So, in a way, it left the victims with the sense that it wasn't finished, and the program of reparation have not yet been implemented, or they are in the process of being implemented. There are many Togolese who feel that the mandate of the commission was useless, insignificant. So how can we understand this paradox? If the majority of the Togolese supported the process begun by the commission, it was because it enhanced the perspectives for dialogue, which was begun in the 1990s when democracy came to Togo. Democracy with a harsh apprenticeship. There were many instances of violence. There needed to be an inclusive approach, including all of the different trends. And the real questions behind conflict needed to be asked, because you couldn't just have dialogue. The questions, decisive questions, concerning the right to free speech had to be asked. The mandate of the commission only represents one stage in a long process that should begin to bring the people as a whole to defining interpersonal relationships, intercommunity relationships, socially and politically. It should, in particular, prompt the state to proceed to institutional reform and enable the victims to obtain reparation for the prejudice suffered and the damage suffered. So in submitting the report to the President of the Republic, the Commission asked the government to ensure that a white book would be published and that there be a body created for implementation and there be a follow-up body created and that there be a program for reparation. What initiatives have been taken here? There was the creation by the presidential decree to strengthen national unity on the 24th of May, 2013. The implementation of the recommendations was given to the Ministry of Human Rights by a presidential decree of the 17th of September, 2013, with the composition of the government. The elimination of the facts from the concerning the assassination of the president of Togo. So basically, what the Commission has done is still symbolic. However, we do believe that the publication, the forthcoming publication of the White Book, will reaffirm the government's commitment. It will define its policy on this subject, and it will make it possible for the process to take off once again with the support of the public, with a view to the implementation of the Commission. Thank you.
Je remercie.
I thank Monseigneur Nicodème Barigam-Benissan for his statement, and I thank him in particular for the questions he asked himself. I thank him for the critical view. It is an honor for the president of the Togolese experience. And I think that the presentations which will be follow will probably prove that commissions of reconciliation, truth, and justice only start a dynamic, and that there are always limits in the implementation. There are expectations which are increasingly ambitious, but the very fact that the reports and recommendations of these different commissions can initiate these dynamics of progressive reforms, I think, is a very positive aspect. I'll now give the floor for a presentation on the Moroccan experience to the head of the Moroccan Equity and Reconciliation Body. Thank you. I will just deal with four points which I think have distinguished the Moroccan experience. First, the experience of Morocco with regard to transitional justice was not aimed at restoring peace, given simply that Morocco was not in a war crimes or genocide situation. Neither was it the goal to change the structures of the state and the institutions which the transitional justice was aimed at. The country was already, and gradually so, ending human rights, and they had the right structures, and it was the conclusion of a series of reforms which were launched since the beginning of the 90s and which were dealt with core issues from the point of view of human rights, and which allowed Morocco to start a series of small reconciliations which have a political, social, and cultural aspect. It is also the result of the convergence of many wills, namely decision-making, but also of the actors in civil societies, activists of human rights, and victims of serious violations of human rights. Secondly, seeking truth for equity and reconciliation. The Moroccan experience was not an easy task. We discovered quickly that the state, the rather deplorable state of public archives, private archives practically didn't exist. And when we tried to see what the doctorates were on political human sciences in the university, we found that all of this research was focused on a period of Moroccan history which was prior to the period of the protectorate. So, basing ourselves on the militant memory of the victims and former officials that we work, trying to clarify this with the political history in the academic world, and trying to also gather oral evidence and what was written in the many complaints received by this body. So it is these difficulties which we were faced with in seeking truth, which pushed the IRA to make several recommendations, which led to the implementation of a modern archive systems and to provide academic training and strengthen research and establish a way of making people aware of this. I would like to mention what the transitional justice was by mentioning the integration of the gender approach in this work throughout the mandate. It's an awareness which occurred progressively, and this was reflected in particular after having received written statements in the complaints of cases which we received and which showed that the harm to women, both indirectly and directly, were much deeper, much more complex, and had a very painful impact on their lives and on their future. So this data was strategic in our choice of taking into consideration this approach in our work. And it's also thanks to the existence among the members and the staff and our staff of the activists of women's movement and even women leaders of the movement. We only had one woman among the members of this body, but she was one of the founders of a very dynamic movement of women and who was acting in order to ensure the development and the advancement of women's rights in Morocco. We must also add that the establishment of the Moroccan Equity and Reconciliation Instance was marked by the central position of the question of the protection and promotion of women's rights in the strategic choices in Morocco. That commitment and this cross-cutting way of dealing with the specificity of serious violations to women led to several measures being taken, both with regard to reparation as well as drafting the outcome report. Now, being aware that that serious violations which women were victims in Morocco allowed us to have very precise information, and we were able to make visible the suffering of women. And the first thing we did at the time was to prepare a study to make visible and identify all sorts of specific violations which women were victims of, and to state how many women were subject to serious violations of human rights. And on the basis of the data we were able to collect for this study, we devoted 27% of the evidence in public hearings on truth and reconciliation for women victims of violations, and also for reparations, taking into account that the harm made to women was very complex. So we abandoned the concept defined by Morocco with regard to succession, and we adopted the principle of rights and equality when we estimated compensation to be given to these women who were victims of serious violations, to ensure equal treatment for both men and women. We also tried to guarantee systematically an increase of 10 to 20% of the compensation directly to women in all items for compensation. In preparing our final report, we tried to ensure that in each part of the report, we would highlight all of the violations which women were victims of throughout the whole report. We also considered that the complexity and multiplicity of the harm which these women were victims was due to the fact that they were women, and all the difficulties on the status of women in Morocco, and our body tried to make a series of recommendations aimed at advancing women's rights as defined internationally. And we devoted a whole sector of these recommendations to make sure that the state reinforced all measures in public policies aiming at the advancement of women, and recommending to the state to meet these commitments for women, and by including in a cross-cutting way gender equality in the whole process of the compensation to be given. To conclude, I believe that the lessons learned from the Moroccan experience on transitional justice is that we cannot have this sort of justice without previously ensuring that there is a good political situation, and without the will of the governments and the NGOs and civil society. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Naima Ben Rahim, and I thank you in particular for emphasizing, instead of repeating the same thing for the different types of experience, for emphasizing what has been different between the Moroccan Equity and Reconciliations experience. I'd now would like to give the floor to Mr. Seri Bailly from Côte d'Ivoire. He's the last speaker, and immediately after that, the questions and answers part will be open. Professor, you have the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking of experience, actually, goes back to the lives of those involved and the difficulties involved in implementing text. Let us begin first with the context. When one refers to the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commissions, we're often referring to the post-electoral crises. This is the most spectacular. But the national consultations that we have organized show that the population wants this to go up until 2010. In other words, to the time of tripartism, politically speaking. Now, the ordinance which organizes this has CDVR, beginning with dialogue. The word dialogue has an importance in the history of the country because the first president, Houphouët-Boigny, at Common Agreement, organized dialogue to deal with the problems of the country. Also, this word provides hope to call up the memory so that people are willing to have reconciliation succeed, and also the hope that through dialogue, the victims and the perpetrators can change and that there be a form of forgiveness, and that criminal justice can do its work also. Now, the ordinance indicates that the CDV should work to achieve this, and the ordinance is important because when we submitted our report following the two-year mandate, most of the reactions said that nothing has been reconciled. Seek reconciliation. This means acting to bring people, positions closer together. But it was also said that this hadn't been, nothing had been reconciled. So reconciliation is very important for us, and this has to be understood so that all of the action taken to bring this about in the medium and long term. Now, with regard to imposition, in the ordinance it says there are regional representatives, and then you have a problem because in every region one can challenge the representative nature of the person chosen. And people can be misunderstood. But the idea is to make an effort that there be balanced representation in terms of the people and the region. The organization, well, apart from the central organization, we are not organized in order to establish local commissions. Actually, there are 36 in the capital and 30 in the regions. So there are four specialized commissions. The Linguistic Commission, which focuses on the profound causes of the crisis. The Investigative and Hearings Commission, the Commission for Reparation, and the Commission, the Memorial Commission. At the end of the 2 years of our mandate, so what had been done? At the beginning of the mandate, there was a great deal of tension in the country, precisely following the confrontation that took place after the elections, and it was important to find the people necessary so as to reduce tension in the country and so that people could listen to each other. We also organized a special ceremony, which we called the mourning for blood. And when men die, the land absorbs the blood. And without that ritual, we thought that everything that would be undertaken would not be successful. And the traditional chiefs insisted that this take place in Abidjan and in the interior of the country. We did that. And we had to reach compromises with the religious people because the Muslims and the Christians were not enthusiastic about becoming involved in that ceremony. So we had to find balance so that the religious on the one hand and so that they could also make a contribution. The national consultations, which should have been done at the beginning of our work, did not produce any results for a variety of reasons, mainly financing, but it did make it possible to respond to a number of questions. For example, the period to be taken into account and the actual methods for the organization of the CDR. Now, with respect to the investigation, it couldn't get off the ground because all of the technical, although all the technical people necessary had been found and the technical texts had been drafted on the basis of what some victims had said, the Commission for Reparation could not work yet because they were waiting for the victims to come forward and to describe the loss they had suffered. And then it would be possible to make proposals to the government. Now, in the end, there was a colloquium, and the different groups participated, the organizations from civil society, the trade unions, and this helped us to think about the profound causes, and it was our hope that if we can identify these profound causes, we will see that we have a common past, but we mustn't continue accusing each other. We have to understand that 20, 30, 40 years ago, and even during the colonial period, choices were made, and this is all a consequence. The responsibility of this, we must all assume individually. We mustn't accuse each other. We looked at the land use, land ownership, and the various crises. Now, what difficulties did we encounter? There were many. The difficulties we presented to the head of state, and in our report at the end of the 2 years, we found at least three main problems. First, the lack of prior agreement among the parties. The parties had just been involved in confrontation. There was a great deal of resentment, and the attacks were continuing, and arrests were continuing, and in that context, it's difficult to listen to somebody talking about reconciliation. Then we also went to the head of state, and we said that the people have the sense that there is selective justice. And then some were skeptical with respect to the success of the work of reconciliation. But despite everything that can be said, all of the people wanted peace. They want reconciliation. And with the liberation experienced at the present time, with the transitional justice, with the return of the exiles, we feel that there's a better outlook for reconciliation. Mr. Chairman, this is what I wanted to say with respect to this. Thank you.
Je remercie le prof.
I thank Professor Ciribelli for his presentation and the experience of Côte d'Ivoire and its critical approach as to the composition and structure and also the final product of the Commission on Dialogue, Truth and Reconciliation. He was the last speaker, the last panelist for this meeting. We have approximately 20 minutes, I would say generously, to hear you. You can ask questions and make comments. I'll try and take 4 to 5 questions. I would ask you, given that I'm not able to identify everybody in this room, to identify yourselves when you take the floor, and kindly be as brief as possible and ask direct questions, focused questions. You have the floor. I have about 3 people who want to. The ambassador of Togo has the floor. Microphone, please. I should like to thank you and through you, all of the panelists, for the excellent statements made in launching the guide for Francophonie of the IOF with regard to the Commission for Truth and Reconciliation. And first of all, I welcome the fact that IOF has filled a void by having this making this guide, because we never had such a tool. I'd also like to add that it is an honor for me that the Togolese experience was selected in the case of this launch, and it isn't necessarily the best experience in Africa, but the Togolese situation was such that the sincerity of the government and the wish to succeed led to the setting up of this commission. The political class in Togo is such that skepticism is not always accepted, and I would like to say that the bishop can bear witness to this. Now, what can we do so that this guide can help future commissions which are set up, in particular in the Central African Republic? As the Undersecretary General on Genocide has said, how can we help those countries who have not been able to implement the recommendations, as is in the case of Togo? You know that implementation requires exorbitant funds. Now, the basic question is, how can we make sure that the commissions which are established are good for the governments, because we have to achieve good results? I think that from that standpoint, I'd like to ask a specific question to our friend from Côte d'Ivoire, because when Togo left the Security Council, we were there last year. No, I'm sorry, in 2012, there was a question of what did the commission do to settle a question of property compared to what the legislation has been in this area? Last question, and this is rather, we speak about the Francophone experience. Is it different from the Anglophone or Arabophone experiences? Because we know that experiences vary from one country to another in Africa.
Je donne la parole à vous deux.
I'll give the floor to your neighbors, to your two neighbors.
Je ne veux pas revenir.
I don't want to go back to some of the aspects my colleague of Togo has just mentioned, for example, the gap to be filled by the guide. But I would like to thank the fact that this has taken place here at the United Nations. The United Nations is the core for the settlement of disputes, and I think it's very important that the guide has been launched here. It really gives food for thought. The panelists have come here and to have shared your experience in a number of countries. It shows the effort that some, not only, but those in Africa, are the efforts they are making to absorb the crises in some of our countries. Taking into account the questions that were just asked by my colleague of Togo, I just wanted to ask or share an impression, particularly with respect to what Monseigneur said and what Madame Naina said and Professor Seri said. Over and above the violence and the crises that led to the establishment of this process in the countries that we're familiar with, isn't there something cultural, something ethnic, which underlies these crises? Didn't you have the impression in the role that you play in these different bodies, these commissions, that the cultural aspects, there are many cultural and ethnic aspects which are the radical cause of some of these crises and which have, in a way, have made people feel this way? Or isn't it isn't it sometimes the ethnic and cultural differences that are barriers? Do you have that impression? Thank you.
Merci.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to thank Francophonie for this excellent initiative, which enlightens us as to this important issue. With regard to Niger, despite some cases of rebellion, we haven't needed to resort to having such a commission, because there weren't so many atrocities, and in particular, we have two important national structures, that is the High Authority for Peace Building and a National Council for Political Dialogue. And this has really allowed us to overcome any problems we've had. But what I would like to ask you is that following the statement of the Assistant Secretary General, when he said rather than stopping at joint commissions, it's better to use the ICC. We know that the ICC is much more repressive, but since there's reconciliation, wouldn't it be important, based on national experience, to develop or rather give priority to a regional experience insofar as the deep underlying causes are much more similar in a geographical region rather than in a cultural region like Francophonie or at international level? So that is a question I have. Thank you.
France.
France has the floor. Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted to make a comment and a brief question. What strikes me is here at the United Nations, when we work on the crisis, it's the short-term objectives that are the focus. The cessation of hostilities, disarmament, demobilization, electoral process. This doesn't happen fast, but these are the objectives that must be dealt with immediately. You have to work on that. But this, our attention is focused on this. They are also their longer-term objectives, which are necessary so that there be a sustainable resolution of the crisis and reconciliation. Here we have the impression that every country, every situation, reinvents in a way itself in these solutions. So I would like to pay tribute to the IOF. It was really important to have this kind of a tool, the toolbox for the and different methods of which have been established and they work, these instruments that are very useful, and stress the importance of doing this work, this compilation of in the toolbox in French, so it is academic, but it's usable. Now, I wanted to support what was said by Amada Dieng. I think that at the present time, Africa is a super laboratory to put into effect these experiments. And we have also the Central African Republic, a country where the human violations of the human rights are so great. The country is totally disrupted by this, and I think that it's difficult to restore a conference unless this question of impunity is dealt with. Of course, there will be the ICC. It is competent for this. And there is, the Security Council the day before yesterday adopted a resolution on this. But the process must bring about reconciliation, justice. This has to get underway. I would be very interested if the IOF could tell us what it is doing at the present time with respect to the Central African Republic. I think the IOF is very involved in this situation. A mission has been sent, and I think it would be very important for us to have some ideas about what is happening in that respect.
Thank you, France. I have two more delegates. My colleague is at the back. I can't identify him in the back of the room. I'm Etienne Chiraptide. I'm from the Mauritian of Rwanda. We would like to congratulate you for this guide. And we're delighted that the experience of Rwanda is contained in it. However, we believe the certain points which could be amended, in particular, when the by explaining the context of what has happened in Rwanda, that it, you don't speak about genocide, but of a civil war. And this was on page 55. A civil war where all the so-called ethnic groups of Rwanda, we call them socialists, were killed. So I think this is rather confusing, and I think this should be corrected. And we encourage the editor to correct that part of the work. And then, on page 89, with regard to the Gacaca courts, I'm sorry that the guide is more interested in the criticism of the Gacaca courts, in particular that these courts allowed more than 1 million Rwandans to be judged, and in a way which led to unity and reconciliation. So now the Rwandans are living together and are working together. They do their daily work together without saying that without feeling that they were Hutus or Tutsis and are going on with their daily work. But it is the guide is important, and I hope it will prevent genocide and other crimes in the future. I thank you.
Merci.
Thank you. Our colleague over there. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Legal counsel for the Mission of Italy, Salvatore Carlacco. Two questions, just briefly. The first, I want to congratulate those who have organized this and for the initiative and the OIF as a whole. Although the document does not seek to draw lessons from this, what lessons have, and although there is not an ideal solution, are there minimum amount of elements that can be taken into account? The second question is, what role can be played by the international community and in particularly the United Nations in supporting this kind of process? In fact, finding truth, reconciliation, and remembrance. Thank you. I thank Italy, and I give the floor to Yemen.
Thank you, Excellency, and I would like also to extend my gratitude to the distinguished panel. The panelists really brought to us a very interesting topic. You, Excellency, you know better than me from your experience in the Security Council that Yemen were also passing through similar path. And we experience rather a unique form of dealing with the transitional justice, because we had to make sort of a lot of discussions in the national dialogue to agree upon major elements of the crisis of the system in Yemen. I would rather support and go in line with what Professor Siray was explaining, that it's about the deformation of the national system from the independence from up till now, and the aggravation and the accumulation of these processes was taking us into the Arab Spring, and we have in the region a very rich experience. I think I would rather invite the panelists, and I invite the United Nations to work on the this expertise that we managed to gather in during the these last 2 years. And I think His Excellency, the Moroccan ambassador, can be a pivotal element into bringing this discussion to the United Nations. We need to talk about national dialogue and what's the meaning of national dialogue, because we have had national dialogues all over the world. But we have now more like this practical guide that focusing on what we need from this national dialogue. In our national dialogue, France was doing something. All the international contributors were doing their part in focusing into issues that we need to remedy all the problems of the course, a resolution of our problems. I would like to hear from His Excellency also his views. Thank you.
Thank you. I give the floor now.
I'll give the floor now first to Burundi, to the representative of Burundi. Before asking my question, it'll be a short one. I should like to commend the work of IOF, impeccable work, which allowed users to have a guide and a reference point that is often lacking in our societies who are trying to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Burundi is a post-conflict country which intends to establish commissions for truth and reconciliation. And I just want to mention a few points which have been made by the panelists. I think that the bishop spoke about the commission in Togo, which he defined as a body for reconciliation, a mechanism for social peace. My question, As you know, reconciliation and peace in a society which has had conflicts, it takes a lot of time. I would like to ask you whether these sorts of commissions are they temporary, or are they for the whole reconciliation period? Thank you.
So now I'll turn to our panelists to respond, because we're really actually running out of time. Switzerland after Switzerland. Switzerland has the floor.
Merci.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. We're also very happy with the launching of the guide. It's a very important thing for sharing good practices in the French francophone area. In treating with the past, you could see that this can help to deal with the durability, the sustainability of the peace process. And this could help greatly for the situation in Syria, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic. My question is, how can we further strengthen the links between the process of treating with the past and prevention in the UN system? And I would also like to refer to an event that Switzerland is organizing with Argentina, Costa Rica, Denmark, and Tanzania on the 4th to the 6th of March, which is the first international meeting on global action against mass atrocities. Thank you.
Merci à la Suisse.
I thank you, Switzerland. Now I turn to our panelists, distinguished panelists. I'll try to reverse the order a bit. So that now the last will be the first. Let us begin with Professor Siri Bailey, and then we'll go from right to left. You have the floor. Thank you. It is important to recognize that land use is an important factor in the Ivory coast crisis, the Côte d'Ivoire, and this relates to the production of coffee, cocoa, and now lacquard. It is not possible to explain the violence, the serious violence that afflicted the west of the country, if you don't relate that to the question of the land. That question is linked to the past. It is linked to our place geographically in the sub-region. And all of that must be taken into account in order to make proposals. We believe that the implementation of the law of 1988 should make it possible to quell the tension relating to land. We also think that instead of just producing cocoa and coffee, if this is diversified and jobs are created, that would help to reduce the tension related to land. So there's also a link to mastering land use and migration at the national and transnational level. Are there cultural and ethnical aspects The crisis in Côte d'Ivoire is also linked to inequality, and the progress of the different regions has to be balanced. The cultural dimension, which often comes up, this has to do with the traditional hunters. The traditional hunters, this is, unfortunately, they are armed, and this could create a problem in resolving the crisis. That is what I wanted to say with respect to the Côte d'Ivoire. Thank you.
Uniquement, malheureusement, uniquement 5 minutes pour terminer cette réunion. Donc, je passe la parole à Madame Benoît Klim. Vous avez une minute et demie.
Just briefly, let me react to the question from the representative of the Italian mission concerning the lessons that one can learn from the experience of the transitional justice. I mentioned two in my statement, but there is another challenge that I think that everyone who has experience in this respect has faced. And sometimes it has not been possible to find a response to these challenges. And it's the question of the implementation of all of the decisions and the recommendations which come from these mechanisms that are established to deal with the questions of these serious violations of human rights. I think that question must be developed and viewed within the process itself before concluding the work of the Truth and Justice Commissions. Thank you. I now give the floor to Crispo. Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, the question was asked about the Francophone experience versus Anglophone or Arabophone or Hispanophone experience. This is not the idea. Rather, we just wanted to highlight the experience of the Francophone area. There are other language-speaking areas, particularly Latin America. So New York is an important political capital, so we just wanted to highlight what happens in the French-speaking world, in the Francophone world. But it is a very rich world. Many things happen here. We have to learn from the past. But now the second question concerning the Central African Republic, this is something we're worried about. We're very active. How to reform the security system to strengthen human rights. This will be the preparation of the forthcoming elections. Now the third question, what is the IOF doing to implement or to benefit from what is happening, well, at least what the guide has indicated. Very specifically, a few months ago, the Mali authorities decided to create a dialogue and reconciliation, a 33-member commission. They arrived without knowing very well what was expected of them. There weren't any text, what still needed to be done. And what did the IOF do? The IOF, in less than 3 weeks, invited the people responsible who were to head the commission, Senor Maiga also from Togo, and the former president of Burundi, Mr. Buyua, who came to explain Burundi's experience and what his commission did, and we also did that We also brought experience from the synergy interaction with the United Nations. And after 3 days of meeting, the members of the commission wanted the IOF unanimously to stay with them for the next 3 years. And this is what the IOF does with respect to truth and justice commissions. The first question was asked about ethnicities. Over and above the elements that we presented, we didn't have the impression that it was ethnic conflicts that were involved in our countries or the other African countries. Perhaps when you look at things at first sight, one has the impression that it's ethnic groups that are in conflict, but actually the reasons are political in nature. It's the politicians who are manipulating the different ethnic groups. And there are also questions concerning land. Who owns the land? Who the first one who gets the land? Or are there other things involved? There are questions of social justice when one has the impression the government is favoring a certain group of people. Then there is a sense of frustration which explodes at the time of the election. Now, the second question concerns the transitional justice mechanism as a strategy to bring peace to society. This was not the mandate given to our commission. We had the impression that ultimately the results, the most tangible result, was that the commission should make a contribution to bring peace to the country. That wasn't written in the mandate, but we found that that was the first result that made it possible for our mandate to be carried out up to the actual drafting of the recommendations. I think that the first step is extremely important. If there can't be peace, then the work of a commission cannot be carried out successfully.
Merci, Monsignor.
Thank you, Monsignor. The last word to Professor Fabrice Hukabig. Thank you, Chairman. Perhaps a response to the question asked about the lessons, the practical lessons from the guide. Perhaps to say that there were 3 points. The first lesson is the question of the duration of the mandate and the interpretation of the mandate. The director actually talked about what happened in Mali and Madagascar. One of the first points where the organization worked when the commissions were established was to define the parameters and the modalities for the exercise of the mandate. The second lesson concerned the diversity of here on that. You find that the traditional possible truth, diversity, and reconciliation are processes that integrate national justice and customary justice, because national justice and customary justice have a kind of legitimacy. So the bringing this nearer to the process involving the people, the more successful it can be. And this brings the third lesson, the need to have interaction among all these processes at the national level, at the customary level, at the international level, the judiciary, parajudiciary, extrajudiciary processes, and their complementarity. And this is what makes the process effective. The last lesson that one could learn from the whole range of institutions, and this was said earlier, is the need for to have sincerity, honesty, and this is for the authorities first and foremost, through decrees or legislative, they establish the process. But without the sincerity, there has to be those participating in all of the fact finding. Thank you. Last word to His Amadieng, Undersecretary General.
Merci, Monsieur President. Juste pour dire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to say that where there is exclusion, there is necessarily trouble. And the ambassador of Burkina Faso was quite right when he mentioned the question of ethnicity. This has been found in a number of countries. The powers in office tend to exclude people who belong to other ethnic groups. And it is quite clear that a situation like that generates a a sense of frustration, which eventually prompts people to take up arms and to seek to exercise power. So it is essential that we deal with diversity in a constructive way in our countries, whether here or in Latin America or in Africa. Now, the ambassador of Niger, asked a very important question concerning the courts. I think that if we have a structure that exists, better to strengthen it, because the finances today are very scarce. Now, having said that, I'm also in favor of regionalization. That's something different. If you take the case of today, the African Chambers in Abidjan that's sitting in Dakar, but ideally it would have been that this to be judged by states who had incorporated in their legislation this question of universal competence. Senegal did it. Unfortunately, we know that there is a whole debate going on, a sectoral debate, that the African Union, with the support of the European Union, has made it possible for the African Chambers to sit, to say, in Sinabre. But we have to make an effort to support the national jurisdictions through our respective countries. This is one of the missions of the United Nations, to strengthen respect for these chambers, but also we have to move on to action, as the ambassador of Togo said. Efforts are being made by the UNDP, by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, playing an important role in terms of technical assistance to the national fact-finding commissions, and it is in this context that I have supported the Togolese Commission at the time at the request of the High Commissioner. But I just want to take this opportunity to say big thank you to everyone. Thanks Switzerland, which recalled the March meeting in Costa Rica, where we will actually have the focal point for the prevention of genocide. Other countries, Cote d'Ivoire, Tanzania, and I hope that all states can be there and join that forum for the prevention of genocide. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Undersecretary General. Thank you, all the panels. Let me take 10 seconds to express appreciation and for announcements. Appreciation to express my colleague, Savadogo Fibib, and his whole team, who has so perfectly organized this meeting. Really, really, you were really the foot soldiers with your dedication behind the excellent conduct of this meeting. And the second announcement concerns the reception will take place today at 6 p.m. at the headquarters of Francophonie. You'll have an opportunity to ask the questions that you didn't dare to ask here in public. You'll have all the panelists there with you. And third and last, I want to express appreciation to the interpreters for their patience and the secretariat. And I do wish to thank you for our having run over for 15 minutes. The meeting is adjourned.